This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at the quiet cyber war waging behind computer firewalls. Our guest is training a new cadre of cybersecurity specialists to defend our vulnerable critical infrastructure. We'll talk about the FBI's raids on Michael Cohen's office and home. This is Trump's attorney.
The initial reaction amongst a lot of people was, this is good. But on second thought, all a person who's a possible defendant has against the power of the state is a confidential relationship with his attorney. What happens if that's threatened?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. America's information technology infrastructure is attacked on a daily basis. Some say our national cyber defense is woefully inadequate to protect against cyber incidents. Hackers have gained access to our personal information stored by huge retailers such as Target and Home Depot, gaining access to millions of credit and debit card numbers. In 2014, J.P. Morgan Chase announced a breach affecting 76 million households. The Government Accountability Organization reports a nearly 800% increase of threats to federal agencies between 2006 and 2012, at a cost likely to exceed $400 billion. Despite this, and evidence of Russian tampering with the 2016 elections, Donald Trump recently announced that he was getting rid of the top cyber policy advisor role. This was a position designed to help streamline the government's overall approach to cybersecurity policy across federal agencies. Compounding problems of coordination is a lack of shortage of trained cybersecurity professionals to fill the growing number of jobs. Joining us to talk about cybersecurity and training such professionals is Professor Nasir Memon, founder and chair of New York University Tandon School of Engineering Cybersecurity Program. The engineering school was one of the first to implement a cybersecurity program at the undergraduate level. In 2002, Professor Memon founded Cybersecurity Awareness Week, an annual conference where tens of thousands of students compete in events and learn skills in cybersecurity. He is also co-founder of Digital Assembly, a software company that develops digital forensics and data recovery, and Vivek, a company that produces malware detection software. The professor's research and commentary is widely published in scholarly and mainstream press. Professor Nasir Memon, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, we were excited to learn about New York University's Tandon School of Engineering Cybersecurity Program. Mm-hmm. I understand it's one of the first, if not the first, in the nation.
First in the sense of having that degree of partnership with industry, first in the sense of its openness, in the sense its ability to take people from non-STEM fields and bring them into cybersecurity. I can sort of expand upon that a little bit. So we all know, and you read the papers or in the media all the time about a lack of cybersecurity professionals in the country. I mean, there's data out there saying by 2022, we need 1.8 million people in cybersecurity, according to Frost and Sullivan. I don't know how they arrive at these estimates, but one thing I can be very sure of is the need is only increasing, right? And right now, today, there are about 300,000 jobs that are open in cybersecurity, according to CyberSeek, and this number will only increase, I believe. So then, how does one go about addressing this need for cybersecurity talent, right? Most of the cybersecurity education and training that happens often happens at the graduate level, because there is a base sort of knowledge and understanding that may be needed of computer science or business or law, and then upon that you build cybersecurity. So there is data out there that 51% of the millennials are either unemployed or underemployed. There is data out there that indicates that this was a McKinsey study that indicates that millennials are carrying around a $2 trillion debt load. And higher education, the tuition rates have only been increasing at rates much faster than inflation, right? So in order to reach out to people and get them to join the master's programs, one needs a program that's affordable. And I think you can, using today's technology, using the fact that content can be digitized and then can be delivered efficiently and effectively, one can create programs that are affordable and at the same time of higher quality than what we have done in the past, right? So the affordability is a key issue. And the Cyber Fellows gives you an entire master's degree for $15,000, which is unprecedented. So in that sense, it's a first, right? The second is the flexibility in the sense that our programs are designed on the availability of professors rather than students, right? Classes happen on a particular campus at 6 p.m. and you need to be there going through traffic or subway system or whatever. In today's sort of networked, interconnected, digitized world, it doesn't have to be that way. So having things online, if you will, or having these virtual campuses, if you will, that those allow, give students the flexibility now to pursue education without being burdened by a particular time schedule and without having to sacrifice their effectiveness in their jobs, right, which they may have.
And it seems especially appropriate given the subject matter that this would be an option.
Precisely, right. And the third is the industry partnerships. I mean, cybersecurity, I believe, is a very practical discipline. Academics tend to focus more on theory, which is right. They should, because theory is essential. You need good practice is grounded on good theory. But one cannot stop with theory. And you don't learn cybersecurity by simply talking about it. One needs that hands-on engagement because cybersecurity is what we call an adversarial discipline. There is an adversary involved, right? So in order to learn how to engage with an adversary, one has to have hands-on experiences. And the Cyber Fellows Program has partnered with some of the leading companies in the country to help create these adversarial sort of hands-on experiences. And the New York City has kindly sort of volunteer to provide some access to its Cyber Command facilities where students will get some experience in this. And then I believe the fourth most important thing is the openness. If a student wants to do a master's in cybersecurity, typically most universities say, oh, you need to have a background in computer science or information technology or computer engineering or something of that sort because that's what you will be sort of building upon. But if you look at it, we graduate twice the number of psychology majors than engineers, right? So after high school, students make a choice of a discipline for good reason that does not result in a technology opportunities in the technology world. And later on in life, if they want to go that way, they suddenly face barriers that... So we designed something called the Bridge Program, which says for a very low cost of $1,500, come on in. No matter where you're from, English, psychology, doesn't matter. Music, it doesn't matter. We will make you go through a 4 to 6 month intense boot camp, if you will, that will train you in computer science and what all you need to know in order to be able to qualify to do our master's program. And the students who do well, we admit them, right? So we suddenly, no longer only people who have had a STEM education, and they're very few, and most of them are very gainfully employed. So no longer it's only them who can do a master's in cybersecurity, but it's literally anybody, as long as they can sort of learn the competency, learn, get over the deficiencies using this very flexible and affordable bridge program that comes with the Cyber Fellows. So.
How important is it for a student to have a sort of an innate curiosity for building or rather tearing things apart to get at how a program or code is written. Is that sort of like some people say, you know, if you're an artist, you have to be born with certain qualities. Do you think that applies to this field?
In some sense. So with the caveat that cybersecurity is a broad field, everybody needs security, and the job roles are quite diverse, right? So if you look at the offensive end, where you are trying to find vulnerabilities, not necessarily for exploiting them, but to be able to then find it and then put a defensive measure around it, then you need that curiosity. You need to have that kind of an innate talent that allows you to pinpoint and press your finger at the right point and bring the whole system down, right? And I think some of it, so that comes with curiosity. And in my 2 decades in working with students, not everybody has it. I've seen some who are not very good at other courses, right? I often have to save them from being suspended because their grades are bad. But they're really wonderful at finding vulnerabilities and fixing them. And so that's definitely one aspect of it. I think the second aspect also is this what we call the security mindset, which is the ability to question trust assumptions and the ability to see trust assumptions too, right? So one of the great thought leaders in cybersecurity, Bruce Schneier, I remember an example he gave, was consider the case where you drive up to a restaurant and there's valet service and you give your car to the valet attendant and you walk into the restaurant and you think things are fine. But actually what you don't realize is that you've given that person the full ability to drive to your home. Why? Because there's a GPS there, which has a home button, and the person can simply say, okay, drive me home, right? And we'll go to your home, and there's a garage door opener out there, so they can get into your home, rob your home, and come back while you're enjoying your dinner, right? Of course, this doesn't happen, but in the cyber domain, being able to see this, that this potentially can happen, to question all the trust assumptions. Because at that point, we are making an implicitly trust decision, saying that I trust this valet not to do this, right? And we don't even think about it. But that doesn't work when you're defending. You have to be able to look at a system, identify the trust assumptions, and then see what if they're violated, because that's what an attacker does. An attacker violates trust assumptions. So that ability also is needed. And then third is the kinds of jobs where you're simply making sure that you're analyzing incidents. So more of an analytical mind is needed, because you're basically trying to solve a mystery in some sense, that you have some data indicating something bad has happened, so the ability to dig in and analyze the situation. And perhaps the fourth is where you are working on the compliance side of things, where you're making sure that all the right sort of boxes are checked and all the right procedures are in place. And that's sort of a job that requires a person who has the discipline, mental discipline and the care they can pay, the attention they can pay to details, right? So I think there's a variety of skills depending on the kind of job role. But that curiosity thing is very interesting, because that's where I see some of the most talented people in this domain.
Many critics say that really since the 1980s, after President Reagan passed the first cyber directive, mm-hmm. that our government has not marshaled an effective and coordinated cyber defense plan. And I understand that for reasons of national security, we may not know all of the ins and the outs of really how prepared this nation is. But mm-hmm. it certainly seems with the number of attacks that businesses and even government are having, that we are vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Do you think we could be doing a better job in terms of the government helping to create more defense for our, say, for our critical infrastructure, networked, you know, electricity?
So we could always be doing a better job, but nevertheless, there are a couple of issues here, right, that First of all, defense is hard in the cyber world. Again, a thought leader in cybersecurity, a person named Dan Gehr, made the statement that if cybersecurity was a soccer game, it would be halftime and the score would be 1,500 versus 1,300 goals, right? Because everybody's scoring goals all the time. Offense is dominant, right? It's very easy to do offense, extremely difficult to do defense, because in defense you have to protect each and single sort of vulnerability. You have to make sure all the doors and windows are all sort of locked, if you will. But the bad guy simply has to find one way to get in, right? So defense is very hard, and we still don't know how to do it. In hindsight, it seems easy, right? But there are always loopholes that a bad guy can find. So imagine we know about tax loopholes and loopholes in laws that the government creates in good earnest, right? And we have a big complex law, and we know that the larger, more complex it is, the more possibilities of loopholes that could be sitting in it. Now think about program like an operating system, which has tens of lines of code, which are instructions on what to do, right? And there are problems in there, and there are loopholes, so-called, in them. It's very hard for us to find them. In hindsight, they look very obvious, but it's hard to find them. So that's one point, that defense is hard. The second issue is that now governments, as we know them today, or the state as we know it today, which is what, a few hundred, of 500 years old or whatever, was formed with security as its core
mission,
right? But in the cyber world, now is the government responsible for providing security as well? The answer is not clear. In the government also has, or the systems that we create, have a notion of space geography associated with it, right? There's a notion of jurisdiction, and that allows you to then secure things. In the cyber world, there is no space, no notion of geography. There's no notion of jurisdiction in some sense. Somebody sitting in planet X could be simply coming in and hacking your system. So
a rogue actor, in a
rogue
way.
Actor could be anywhere, yep, on the planet, right? So that makes it difficult to do defense, or to give government the responsibility of doing defense. And I think the third aspect might be that, at least in the U.S. government, the way the system works, their representatives, who are elected to hopefully listen to the will of the people and enact laws that the people would ask for, somehow cybersecurity is not what people are screaming for, right? So the elected representatives somehow perhaps are not seeing that as a priority, because their constituents are talking about perhaps safety of guns, or perhaps gay rights and other such issues, and cybersecurity is not, and even privacy is not an issue that the constituents are screaming at their representatives about. So it makes it hard for the government to act, I believe.
Now, I want to ask you what sort of your dream plan might look like, but before that, how much does plain old human error factor into a weak cyber defense?
Today, the way systems are built, and operated, quite a lot, right? The chief of tailored access for NSA, who's essentially a euphemism for chief of offense, Bob Joyce, in a public conference, he made the statement that 0 days are overestimated. So 0 days are these very complex exploits, the weapons, if you will, that we have based on vulnerabilities that people yet don't know about. And
the software company doesn't know,
right? Yep. And they're not fixed; they're sitting there. And the word is out that intelligence agencies go about stockpiling these 0 days so they can use it for their mission,
like Eternal Blue,
something like that. Right. But Bob Joyce says that they are overestimated. Good old phishing works. Basically, send an email to the right email to the right person, and you're in now.
Now, getting them to open an attachment.
Yeah, right. And now the thing is that, do I blame these people? Not really. I think we should be designing systems that are more robust to human error. If I click on attachments and good things happen 99 times out of 100, I'll just keep clicking them. And if you ask me to look at some complex string of where it's coming from, et cetera, and especially in today's world, and one is sitting in front of a computer doing multiple things, multitasking, and I've done some studies in the past on cognitive overload, right? We are thinking about multiple things, and we don't pay attention. In fact, there was a recent fMRI study which basically established that as somebody sitting and working and as security warnings pop up, people are not paying attention to it, right? And I think people have been desensitized, and they are going through this information overload, and they are under cognitive load, and one has to be sympathetic to them and not blame them, and somehow design systems that are more robust. Of course, one should train them, make them more aware, and make things perhaps more more visible, but up to a point, right? So the problem with cyber is that I'm sitting on my laptop working. I cannot see who's coming in, going out. Unlike in my house, and I'm sitting there and strange people are coming in, going out, I would get alerted, right? But on a laptop, I mean, there are all kinds of sort of connections are being made to different countries. I just don't get to know it. So that visibility is not there. You don't want to give too much visibility because that results in overload. But perhaps we need to find the right metaphors so that people get alerted and act in the right way, make the right security decision. We just don't know how to do it yet.
You were one of the authors on called Cultural and Psychological Factors in Cybersecurity. Asks the question, is it possible to create a model for participants' secure behavior, self-efficacy, and privacy attitude based on the user's culture as well as personality? And you examine factors that contribute to how individuals basically interact in terms of security. Right. And I understand not many people have really looked at that. It seems to make sense, though, given that we're such creatures of habit, as you say, and we become desensitized. Right. How can we address that gap in terms of people's online identities being stolen, their credit card information? Is there an effort underway to educate the user?
In security, when we talk about sort of a situation and the threat model, we talk about Alice and Bob and how Alice wants to send something to Bob. And we think about individuals as being homogeneous, right? Alice and Bob. But individuals are very different. They have, depending on their personalities, their culture, where their ethnicity, etc. And my thinking was that cyber defenses need to be customized to the individual, that I'm inclined to do certain things, whereas a colleague of mine would probably not do those things. So my defenses should take that into account. It turned out it's hard to do, and we had a hard time even getting the permissions to study the personality of people and their habits, because there's lots of privacy and legal issues start coming into play. There has been some nascent work in the research world about looking at something like that, sort of customizing security. But unfortunately, the only thing we do today, I think, in getting people to be more aware is we hire vendors to simply constantly try to attack them. And when they make mistakes, then they're told that, hey, look, you shouldn't have done this. So there are companies who, for example, do phishing, send a phishing email to the entire set of employees, and people who click then are told, hey, you should not have clicked.
Right, they're testing their system
for the level of security. Hoping that they do this. But you know what? I remember talking to CIO of a reasonably large bank, and he said, oh, yeah, we're down to 12%. The bad guy just needs one person, right? And 12% means like you're hugely vulnerable. Right. But we've not been doing this, as far as I know.
Well, at the engineering school in the cybersecurity courses, how big a problem in terms of national security, for example, are the hacks that are occurring every day? I mean, look at the allegations that Russia meddled in the 2016 presidential elections. That's a different kind of interference and going not only after local election polls and places, but on social media to create, foment a discord among U.S. citizens. How big a concern are all of these factors in your courses? And
so these are very recent, so we haven't been talking about these in our courses as much, right? Hopefully they will come in as we evolve our curriculum. For a long time, we were worried about confidentiality. We tried to protect information, your credit card number, and your bank account, and all that stuff. And we're getting better at it. Then there was availability issues like DDoS attacks and things of that sort. And we solved it to some extent, although that because of the shared nature of the network, it's always there. But now what is being questioned is like this notion of integrity, right? And that seems that it can affect basic democratic institutions. And that is of concern. Now, I guess nation states have always tried to influence the politics of each other, depending on which side you are in. But the scale and precedence at which the scale at which can be done now is unprecedented. It's just amazing. Moving forward, we need to find a way to address this.
I understand that a year or two ago, the Pentagon held what they called a Hack the Pentagon program, seeking new talent from individuals. We have some very harsh and rather antiquated laws on the books here, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the threat of long punishments for young hackers who may really lack the criminal intent but are just those kind of curious tinkerers. And they perform, many of them perform a valuable task of penetrating systems just like the professionals do to look for vulnerabilities. Do you see a role for these individuals in society, the ones who aren't going to your program, the ones who may not even have the money for that, but sit in their bedrooms and hack into even, you know, government systems, private security companies?
Yes, yes. And we want them to come to our program and we'll find scholarships for them. So this is something that we at NYU have been doing for a long time. The Pentagon may have done it last year, and there are many others who have been doing it in the last few years. But about 15 years back at NYU, we started something called Seesaw. It was a cybersecurity competition, right? Today, it's in its 15th year, and we have about 20,000 students that participate all over the world. We have finals in five countries, hopefully, in New York here in our Brooklyn campus, in Israel, and this year it'll be in Haifa University, in the Middle East. It used to be in Abu Dhabi. This year it'll be in Tunisia. In Europe, in France, in India, in IIT Kanpur, in Mexico City this year as well.
What about Armenia?
No.
If
she can find somebody who's willing to host it. So the way we do it is there's a preliminary round where everybody competes and they are trying to sort of exploit in a constrained and a limited setting. And then we pick the finalists from North America, bring them to New York City. We pick the finalists from Europe, they go to France. Finalists from Middle East go to Tunisia. From India, go. So we could carve out another part of the world where finalists could go.
And these are individuals from all sorts of different backgrounds.
Yes, yes. And we give them scholarships. We say, hey, you did well in Seesaw, you want to come and join NYU, we'll give you a scholarship. And companies are there recruiting these students. Government agencies are there also watching them, recruiting them. And so it's well known that there is a... I know people who are very good at this who never even finished high school or are barely finished high school or never moved beyond first year of college because they got just bored in college. And then they're doing very well today. They make more money than I do. And they've been very successful and they're well known. So... there is a place for them, but they're more of this offense kind of people. So the Pentagon might have a need for offense, right? But companies also need to because offense allows them to understand how to do better defense, right? It's by having
you need both.
You need both. Yeah.
I want to go back just for a minute, and you mentioned the practical component at the NYU School of Engineering's program, and that's working cyber fellows that may partner with New York City Cyber Command. Mm-hmm. That must be pretty exciting because New York is known for having the largest anti-terrorism units in the world, basically. Sure. Do they get to do that kind of work? Can you talk about what they do?
Anti-terrorism work, no, right?
No.
But
isn't cyber defense...
Right, but these students would not be participating in that.
Uh-huh.
Right? So they would simply be essentially doing academic exercises in an environment. So what happens is, so what's a cyber range? The Cyber Command has a cyber range. What's a cyber range? It's simply a simulated environment of a reasonably large company, right? So medium-sized company. Today, when we give students hands-on experiences, it's more of try to sort of find an exploit on this computer or on this web service or this web server, examine it for vulnerabilities, examine this code for vulnerabilities, etc. We give them a target, right? In a cyber range, now they're seeing a network, a reasonably complicated network with a few hundred, maybe even 1,000 nodes that are communicating with each other. There's artificial traffic going on, the service is running, and now the students have to go in and do some exercise. Of course, it's artificially created, so we know where the vulnerabilities are and we place them so that it's doable. But they and now they have to sort of, it's more realistic that they would be now scanning the network, looking for vulnerabilities, because that's what they would be doing in a real job, right? It's more more closer to a realistic scenario that they would be facing when they enter the workforce. So it's just that, yeah.
So what I'm getting is that the whole concept of cybersecurity is extremely difficult given the pervasiveness of how we're all online,
right,
and the anonymity,
right,
of different threats.
Right.
But if you were hired by the government, we were in a, say we had a threat that our nation was going to be attacked in terms of critical infrastructure, and you had to marshal an emergency plan, Do you have any idea what that might look like?
So first I would ask them to invest in people, train people with the right skill sets who understand this infrastructure. A lot of this infrastructure is, to be honest, quite archaic, very old stuff in it. And that's because we, as a wealthy nation, built them long time ago. And it's working and we...
So I heard that some government agencies are still using floppy disks. That can't be true.
Maybe. I know they're using Windows XP for sure, right? And things of that sort. So floppy disks, maybe. And so train people and invest in research. That's the third thing I would probably tell them is that many of these things, do they really have to be connected? Okay, you'll spend more money. Maybe it'll cost more.
Go back to pre-internet of things.
And the really important things. It may turn out that it's you pay a larger price for it. The cost is higher, but in the long run, it might be worth it, right? So I'll ask. So there needs to be a very clear analysis of really what do we really need to be connected, and make sure things that are not that. Not connecting them necessarily safeguards them. I mean, we know that sort of air gap is sometimes not enough. But nevertheless, that's a step that's essential, I believe. And then also, I think technology is not going to solve this problem by itself. I think you need the right policies and incentive mechanisms. What they are, we have to work that out. In fact, at NYU, we have now a program with the law school whereby students coming in, they take engineering courses as well as law courses. So you can create these policies with good knowledge about technology. So I think you need policies that regulate the critical infrastructure. Regulation is a bad thing. I understand that. But some amount of it is needed because a large part of a private infrastructure, unlike some other countries, is in the hands of the private
sector.
And private sector is often can be short-sighted, and there's a profit motivation and incentive, but it's the laws and the regulation frameworks that we have that allow us to keep them sort of...
in check.
Yeah. Thank you.
As we conclude, I just wanted to ask, if you don't mind, on a personal note, how did you become interested in IT systems and cybersecurity. I read that you started off before we were all so on computers writing, handwriting code or doing things on paper.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. So, yeah, it goes back to my undergraduate days when I was a very, very bad student. I used to flunk all my classes, and I remember taking a computer science because I was not serious about it, right? I just didn't go to classes, so obviously you flunk them. But the computer science course, I mean, again, I didn't go to class, but I just found it so easy. We used to write programs on paper at that time, and I had an aptitude for it. I could do well. I used to also be a very good bridge player. Maybe there is a connection between right. the two. I don't know. At some point in life, when I had to make a turn and I had to sort of leave India and find some new things to do, my friends told me, remember computer science? You were good at it. Why don't you give that a shot? And I came here and joined a master's in computer science. And luckily, the university is here who gave me that second opportunity that despite a very bad GPA, they still admitted me. And I believe, and that's why I like the Bridge program, because it's a program that gives a second opportunity. This is the land of second opportunity. And it gave me that. And I never thought I'll do a PhD in computer science. In fact, many of my undergrad professors, if they heard that I'm a professor today, they probably have a heart attack or something. They would be. I never thought about that. But the more I learned it, the more excited I got. And I was inspired by my professors. And they mentored me. And I ended up doing a PhD. And I was working on cryptography. One of my advisors was an expert in cryptography. And not security in the sense it was more mathematical at that point, nothing to do with systems and things of that sort. And then I came here to Brooklyn. They asked me to teach a course in computer security, and I taught one, and I thought, you don't do computer security just by talking about it. Cryptography you do, but computer security you need labs. So with my own research money, I created a little lab, and I put students in it, and it caught fire. I mean, students just loved it, and I saw the energy. And I've always, and still am, much in touch with students, right? I interact with them a lot. And they are the ones who got me into this. Just their energy, their enthusiasm, their ideas. They walk into my office, and it's really them that I derive my energy and passion from.
Well, I think they're very lucky, yeah. And NYU is lucky to have such a great program.
Thank you.
Thank you for being on Law and Disorder, and we hope to talk with you again sometime.
Sure.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The attorney-client privilege has been in the news with the unfolding Trump scandals in bringing about the FBI raid on Trump's attorneys Michael Cohen's home, his office, and his hotel room, where a number of documents and computer files were seized. What is the attorney-client privilege, and to whom does it apply? Generally speaking, the privilege is owned by the client. Unless the client waives her rights, her lawyer is barred not only from revealing any information about the client, but even revealing who the client is. an exception in the case of the FBI raid on Donald Trump's attorney's office, home, and hotel room was made on the grounds that there is a fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege. Defenders of the attorney-client privilege, even if it has to do with protecting Donald Trump, have argued that it is illegal and unprincipled for the Justice Department to get a search warrant from a federal magistrate and violate the principle. These people argue that it is wrong to argue that any stick will do to beat a dog, and that making an exception in the case of Trump could backfire. They are worried now that the camel's nose is under the tent. We speak today with Minneapolis attorney Carla Shellberg. She has litigated cases involving sensitive family law matters and worked with unions and political activists. All these clients had a stake in not having their affairs or names revealed. Carla Shellberg, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the attorney-client privilege. What is it and who can assert it?
So the attorney-client privilege is, actually it's two things. The first thing it is an evidentiary rule that prohibits courts, tribunals from requiring individuals who acted as an attorney to divulge information. It also is an ethical rule that applies to attorneys. It's two things. In the context that we've been talking about it, it is a evidentiary rule that protects attorney-client communication. Now, it's actually kind of specific in who it applies to. So you need to be someone who has contacted a specific lawyer for a specific question, you know, that you've actually hired him or her to do something, to represent you in a specific manner. And if in that process you communicate something, that is protected by attorney-client privilege. It is owned by the client, not the lawyer.
Meaning the client is the one who can elect to violate it or not.
Correct, unless it falls under an exception that the court would not honor the privilege claim.
So do you believe that it was legal to raid Trump's attorney's office and his hotel room and his home and seize his files and the computer data that they got? What was your reaction to that?
I was actually okay with that, to be honest. I was not okay with the court requiring Cohen's lawyer to disclose the identity of his third client. But let's go back to the raid. But I don't have enough information, neither does anybody else. It is quite possible that they have effectively found that there was evidence that, and it would have to be President Trump, was using his relationship with Cohen to further a crime, to further fraud. Now, here we've got to trust the system, right? And that's always the question. Do we really trust the system? But the system is set in place where there has to be a judge has to review specific factual allegations, and they have to be evidence that they already have. They can't go there for a fishing expedition. So if they did that, then I'm okay with it. And here's why. And I'm going to give you an example from Minnesota, that people have used the attorney-client privilege in order to create fraud for as long as the rule has been there. Now, what people talk about most is the mob cases, right? But I want to talk about something else that you and I would completely agree with. So here in Minnesota, the Attorney General sued the tobacco industry for basically fraud. I mean, it's more technical than that, but it's basically you knew that this stuff was deadly, you knew how deadly it was, you knew how addictive it was, you lied to everybody, made a lot of money, and killed a lot of people. And one of the things that was talked about there is the fact that they knew how deadly it was and they knew how addictive it was, but they tried to keep that quiet and to themselves and not disclose it in discovery or in the court process. And how they did that is in all of their scientific research, they involved a lawyer. In every single part of it, the hiring of the research, the implementation of the research, they had the communications of all of that CC'd and in the presence of counsel. Now, you and I can both say that's fraud, right? We don't want attorney-client privilege to be able to cover that. So you asked me, was I upset about the raid? It is really important for us progressives to not sit here and just cheer, right? And not just say, oh my gosh, the FBI is coming to our rescue, the Justice Department is coming to our rescue, and they're gonna right all of this, right? We know that we can't trust that. So what really upset me is that the judge did not take the discretion she could with regard to allowing the disclosure of the third client in camera. So there's been a lot of conversation about is the fact that you have hired this particular lawyer, is the existence of the attorney-client privilege in itself privileged? Or the existence of the attorney-client relationship in itself privileged? And most courts will say no, that it's not, except there's some exceptions. The one is that the information would implicate the client in the very criminal activity for which the legal service was sought. So the identity of the client, the consequence of the client and attorney privilege. And the other one, and this one kind of covers the issue with Hannity, right? Another exception is when the disclosure of the client's identity would reveal the nature of the legal problem or personal confidential information about the client. So that one is what we were all, at least what I was upset about. I mean, everybody assumed, oh, it's Hannity. That means he paid somebody off, right? She could have used her discretion to do the responsible thing there, and she chose not to.
Carla, that leads me to a related topic, which is the duty to minimize the disclosure of confidential information. Can you briefly talk about that? I was just thinking that information is made available, and is there a need to sort of sift through and only release what is absolutely necessary, say in a criminal case, to prove certain identities or that a case exists? Do they have to screen it?
Well, they have to screen it. It's a little different than what you laid out. They have to first identify that the only information, so yes, they have to screen it. The only information that they can release is information that goes to the question, did the client use the attorney in the furtherance of the commission of a crime or fraud? So there are cases where, I'm thinking of one in particular where somebody who owned a company was trying to defraud his ex-wife or something like that, and he was transferring the company to somebody else. And the tax attorney made a email to the accountant saying, hey, from now on, don't do anything because I'm thinking of having the taxes done in Mr. Smith's name instead of Mr. Jones's name. And the court said, look, you don't, that's not enough. That's enough information to make you suspicious, but that's not enough to prove intent of the client. And that's what it comes back to, is intent of the client. Now, this is kind of interesting. I mean, it was, you're right, that warrant was broad. we're talking about his home, his office, and his hotel room. That's kind of a different question with regard to was the warrant appropriate. And we can only trust the system, and you and I both know how far we can usually trust the system, but did the prosecutors come with enough information to justify all of those warrants?
Let's speculate here. My suspicion is that if you want to get a magistrate to sign a search warrant, you have to show specifically what you're looking for. You can't do a fishing expedition. And my suspicion is that the stuff that they listed that they were looking for has to do with money laundering, has to do with racketeering, has to do with Trump and his attorney getting money from Russian oligarchs and laundering it for him to build the kind of projects that Trump builds. And that's what I think was probably in the papers to get the warrant. What's your thinking on that?
Well, I think that, and I also think that they handed them such an easy opening. I mean, this whole thing about Stormy Daniels, and I can't remember the timeline here, but this happened right after President Trump said, "I don't know anything about that. You'll have to ask my lawyer." Or I don't know if he said my lawyer or Michael Cohen. And his statement there completely eliminated his attorney-client privilege.
Yes.
Because in order for attorney-client privilege to be appropriate, you have to actually have the client consciously and purposely engage the lawyer for a specific legal purpose. And he just said, "I don't know anything about it, so there's no attorney-client privilege." Now, we all suspect that he's not telling the truth, but certainly that's enough to allow for a warrant for that. And then you have the bonus of getting all the other things that could be associated with that kind of fraud.
So let's look at the other side of this. I spoke with a friend of mine who had one time been the head of the New York State Trial Lawyers Association night before last, and I asked him what his reaction was, because I was curious. You know, our mutual friend Catherine Franke, who's the chairwoman of the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights, her initial reaction was, this could be dangerous, this could backfire. We don't want to do the principle of any stick will do to beat a dog when we're going after Trump. And that was the same kind of reaction that my friend from the Trial Lawyers Association said. He said, you know, this may not be good. It may be that the camel's nose is under the tent. Did you have that kind of ambiguous reaction when you first heard about the raid?
Not about the raid. I had it, and maybe I was too much of a cheerleader, you know, and I admit that. I had it about the disclosure of the Hannity as the client. That made me very concerned. And it reminded me of just what Catherine is worried about and what your friend is worried about, is that we can't be those people. We can't be those people that bend our cheerleading for a certain action of the government or the authority, depending on who's in. I mean, the rule of law is all we have to control our democracy, or to not control our democracy, to maintain our democracy. And that's what we've seen slip away, is the rule of law and the respect for the systems that we've put in place. So I was just making an assumption, well, boy, they must have had something. But what made me really worry is, and this is what I thought the judge was doing, it was almost gratuitous. And I really didn't like that. That's where I thought, okay, we have to pay attention to the fact that these rules have to apply to everybody equally. Because, yeah, in those circumstances, that's exactly the exception I read about. I mean, everybody jumped to a fixer fixing a affair or whatever.
What scares all of us is you have the massive power of the government, of the state, and it can be mobilized against one powerless individual in a criminal prosecution. And all that individual has really got going for him or her is they've got an attorney. And they have to trust that attorney, and they have to know that whatever they say to that attorney is between the two of them. And and you know, we have a couple of friends who went to jail because of the attorney-client privilege.
Absolutely misused. And we are in politically, we are in such an awkward position. As progressives, we are watching. You know, one branch of the federal government, which we have distrusted with good reason for a century, try to stop us from jumping completely off the cliff into fascism. Now, it's not certainly not their total responsibility, but so I'm agreeing with you. We can't allow that feeling of, oh, man, the FBI is on our side this time. Holy, okay, we'll be okay. We can't lie there. But on the other hand, I'm going to poke you a little bit with the attorney-client privilege. We also have to recognize that the attorney-client privilege historically has been used to protect fraud and criminal activity. And I gave you the example of the tobacco litigation, but most notably it is the organized crime. You know, that the consigliere would say, I am so-and-so's lawyer. Nothing they have said to me, I can tell you, because it's protected by attorney-client privilege. And so that's where the law came with regard to the exception of the attorney-client privilege. Well, that's not appropriate. It has to be a specific, at least that's what they argued, that you can't have all of the information. It has to be specific to the what you're hiring the lawyer for.
Well, this is all going to come out in the wash.
but as leftists, Catherine is right. I mean, we have to always question the use of federal power, no matter where it is, no matter if it makes us happy in one instance, and we cannot apply different rules depending on what side we're on.
This has been a very good discussion. Thank you so much from speaking with us from your legal office out there in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and we wish you well. You take it easy.
I will. Fight the good fight, guys.
Thanks,
Talk
Carla.
Talk to you some other time.
Take care.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.